The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, an eventful week for the two national teams in the Olympics, but ultimately both have fallen short of their ultimate goal.
Yeah, fairly disappointing week. I thought maybe the women played maybe their best game of the tournament, just but came up against a very good side in Sweden. And then Japan, they took Spain all the way on Tuesday night, but yeah, just not quite enough to get over the line. So yeah, disappointing, but we've still got our bronze medal game to look forward to.
Most definitely. All right. Well, yeah, we did hope to be hot off the presses and record on Tuesday night immediately after Japan took on Spain. But yes, with that game going to extra time, as Sam predicted it would, I might add, in our personal messaging, that also meant that booking a guest and keeping him to a schedule that suited us all was ultimately impossible. So we've decided to record on Wednesday night instead. And that has meant that Johnny Nicol is able to join us once again. Johnny, welcome back to the pod, and how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good, Ben. It's nice to have some positive things to say about Gamba, and maybe if we look at big picture items, also, well, the Japan men's team too, I think there's some positives we can take there, so I'm looking forward to getting into it.
Terrific stuff. But yes, we will cover Johnny's Gamba Osaka side and their exertions during the Olympic break. Well, Olympic break for almost all the rest of J1. Gamba have obviously been very active in that time. Later on in part two. But yes, let's cover the Olympic teams then, beginning with the men's under-24s, who ultimately, Sam, fell just short against Spain. There's a couple of different ways you could spin it. They were ultimately 5 minutes away from taking Spain to penalties before a brilliant Marco Asensio finish did them in deep into the second half of extra time.
Yeah, it's disappointing when you get that close to a penalty shootout, and the way that Japan put their penalties away against New Zealand, they'd have been quite confident going into that shootout. But I think in terms of the way that they set up, they wanted to try and sit back or sit deep, kind of frustrate Spain. And they didn't concede too many clear-cut chances. I thought for the main, they defended well. And just the only disappointment I really had was the kind of going forward, there was a lack of real clinical edge to them. It didn't ever really look like Japan were going to score. So that was a little disappointing. But in terms of the effort and the application, I can't really fault the players.
Now, we wondered what Hajime Moriyasu might do at the selection table. Obviously, one change was forced on him with Tomiyasu, the centre-back, suspended, and that meant to call Itakura came back into the side. Itakura, must be said, was terrific throughout the tournament whenever he got his opportunity, and was throwing himself around making some terrific blocks, especially late on in the game as Japan were not necessarily hanging on, but were forced into some last-ditch defending on quite a few occasions. Elsewhere, Sam, there's just a lingering frustration for me. Certainly it's much more than lingering for the player himself, and probably for Moriyasu as well, the fact that we never saw Kaoru Mitoma really given a chance to shine at all in this tournament. He's only gotten on, I think, in two of the five games that Japan has played, and was left out of the 18 here. Presumably he was just never quite up to tip-top fitness. And, Moriyasu had given other players chances ahead of Mitoma and probably felt that it was better to keep the players that he'd shown some trust in earlier on in the matchday squad.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure if it's completely fitness-related, actually, because I'd have played him against New Zealand. I think there was no reason for him not to play more in that game. Mm. I think that's the side you want. Yeah, you want a little bit of creativity, a little bit of magic, and that Mitoma can provide that. I don't think I would have played him against Spain. I think maybe I would have gone Sommer over Hatate, but I wasn't really too fussed with that, because he wanted more of a defensive-minded winger, someone who will help get back, the players that Spain had, Oyarzabal and Olmo on the wings. You need help from your wingers. And with Mitoma, Kubo and Doan, if you went with that, I don't think there's a lot helping out the defence there. So I could understand why he wouldn't play in that game. But to not have him on the bench, I think, is disappointing, because especially when at some point Japan were going to have to chase the game, as they were right at the end, and you need a little bit of magic, a little bit of creativity, and he would have been the perfect player for that. So it was quite disappointing. What I excuse me if you think this is kind of a lazy comparison, but I see a lot between this Japan team and the England team in terms of they've got a very kind of cautious manager, but with a lot of good attacking options. And Mitoma is kind of like the Jadon Sancho of the England team, where he missed out on a couple of squads for England. But you look at him and you look at the record, I mean, the goals and assists he gets, you think, oh, he's got to be in every team. So Mitoma is kind of like that. And I don't think he quite fits the mould of a Moriyasu player, who is kind of more defence first and attack second. So, yeah, I worry about Mitoma going forward with Moriyasu as the manager of the senior team, because I think it showed in this tournament that he wasn't quite keen on him, and because maybe he doesn't have that defensive attribute to his game. So that's a little bit worrying, because, yeah, really, I mean, you ask anyone who in our kind of J-League community who do you think maybe would be one of the first names on the team sheet, and it would be Kaoru Mitoma. So, yeah, it was a shame to not really see him, but I think kind of Moriyasu has a little bit more trust in the way that Soma and Hatate play on that left-hand side.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can't really argue with the results. Although, yeah, Johnny, I mean, that's it. With 10 minutes to go in the 90, Spain were able to bring Asensio off the bench. And, I mean, he's not, you know, he doesn't play in the same position as Mitoma, obviously, but he's a terrific player and was obviously able to decide this game from his own boot. And, yeah, it's just... it's just a frustrating thing that, we never really got to see who the player who a lot of us thought was Japan's ace up their sleeve. He just never really got a chance to shine.
Yeah, I think that's I quite like Sam's comparison with Jadon Sancho and how you've kind of broke it down, like comparing like Moriyasu to Southgate. I never really thought about it that way, but I think one of the problems, another problem Mitoma might have going forward, is Japan always play that 4-2-3-1 formation, and there's just always so many players to play the three, and he's kind of in the same generation as Doan and Kubo. There's going to be a lot of competition for him going forward. I mean, there still is time. If he goes to Europe, again, he's probably going to add more strings to his bow. He will have to defend if he goes to Europe. He's going to have to pick up new skills that he might not necessarily have had to do at a kind of a dominant Kawasaki side. But, yeah, I think kind of going forward for Japan, a lot of people have put their hand up. Like, you know that the senior players like Yoshida, Tomiyasu, Sakai, Kubo and Doan, they're essentially like, assuming Japan qualify for the next World Cup, which is only 16 months away, that they've already got their foot on the plane. And then I think you mentioned like Itakura. I think his development's a really good thing for Japan, because I've always seen them as having like two decent centre-backs, but if one of them gets injured, there's always a bit of a problem. So if you then have like Itakura and Tomiyasu and Yoshida, there's three good options there. And I always seem to find myself talking about when I'm on the pod, but Ao Tanaka, I think he's really impressed me in the tournament. Obviously, we kind of questioned, because we were big fans of him in J-League, and he's gone to the Bundesliga 2 over in Germany. And I thought that was a bit of a kind of low move for him. I know we've got some kind of German followers of the pod. It'd be interesting to know what they think. But just seeing him sitting in there with Endo, and especially against Spain, I felt he held his own for large parts of the game against, like we said, a supremely talented Spanish side. So, yeah, Mitoma is obviously a kind of disappointment in this tournament, but I think going forward he may improve, and other players have emerged too. So although the result will definitely sting, the nature of it, I think Japan have a lot to be kind of thankful for, and the fans have a lot to look forward to going forward.
Yeah, well said, Johnny. Okay, so well, we won't go through the game kick by kick, Sam, but I mean, obviously, to kind of sum it up in more broader strokes, the first half was a bit of a struggle for Japan, wasn't it? As Spain dominated possession, I mean, it kind of had reverse echoes of the New Zealand game, where Japan was dominant but unable to find a way through. But yeah, it was clear fairly early on, wasn't it? That Spain were capable of dominating the ball and really making Japan work. And the conditions obviously played a part here, with Japan's fitness tested to its absolute limit.
Yeah, well, I mean, you come into any game against Spain, you kind of know the pattern that it's going to be. They're going to have all the possession. Japan had to sit deep. They had to remain vigilant and concentrated. And for that first half, generally, they did. I thought You've mentioned Itakura played very well, so did Yoshida, and Endo and Tanaka right in front of them did a power of work in front of that back line to kind of limit the space for Spain. They didn't really create too much. There was that one chance there, I think it was Rafa Mir towards the end of the first half, where Kosei Tani, who had a mixed game, I'd say. I think he got a lot of praise for the way, like in this situation, he came out very well and made the save. I think there were other issues with his kicking and decision-making at times, especially in the second half. But in terms of just pure goalkeeping, let's say, and coming out and saving the ball, he did very well. And that was really the only clear-cut chance that Spain created. So from that standpoint, I thought it was a good first half for Japan in terms of just keeping them quiet. But yeah, as you said, they didn't really offer anything going the other way, Japan, and it was a carbon copy of that Japan-New Zealand game. And just with the players that they still had out on the pitch, I did expect a little bit more from Japan on the counter-attack, but they didn't really keep possession very well. Spain are very good at hounding you down once they can see possession themselves and winning it back, and it kind of got to Japan a little bit. I thought they weren't able to kind of get a foothold on the ball and get a good range, a good set of possession going and really alleviate the pressure too much. But yeah, so that aside though, defensively I thought they were pretty solid.
And then Japan made a bright start to the second half, Sam, and Daichi Hayashi was preferred up front to Ayase Wada, and as it has been the case against New Zealand. And an early chance early on in the second half for Hayashi that he thought was deflected wide by a Spanish defender, but the referee, who certainly got mixed reviews on the evening, Mr. Ortega from Peru, he ultimately decided that was a goal kick, much to Hayashi's chagrin. But that was probably Japan's brightest period of the game, Sam, the first 10 minutes of the second half before Mr. Ortega again entered centre stage with his ill-fated penalty decision.
Yeah, that kind of switched the game up a little bit. But yeah, they did start very well, and I think they needed a little bit more of that throughout the game, because you mentioned Japan's tiredness, but this Spain team was tired as well. I mean, a lot of this team played in the Euros back in June. Every knockout game they played went to extra time. They went to extra time again against the Ivory Coast. So that you've got to think, and they're playing in the heat in Japan, that they're probably quite used to it in Spain, actually. But it's still going to be quite difficult for them, the amount of games they've played. Even just this Olympic tournament, the games come thick and fast. And yeah, I just thought maybe that was where Japan could have got at them, with maybe supreme levels of fitness. Because you saw like Dani Olmo towards the end of that second half game really tired and coming off, and a lot of their main players getting tired. So if Japan could have kept that intensity up for a little bit longer than they did at the start of the second half, then that may have been a positive for them, may have been a way to get into the lead in this game. But it kind of, once the penalty decision and it kind of took the flow out of the game a little bit, I thought. And it was a really weird incident, but I think it was like, kind of, we've had a go at VAR quite a bit on this podcast, but I think in terms of what he's brought in for, this was kind of the perfect use of VAR.
This week in VAR. This week in VAR. This week. Well, that's exactly right, Sam. You've mentioned it throughout the tournament that VAR has operated very smoothly, and right throughout the Olympics in both the men's and the women's tournament. And we saw it again here, Johnny, when the referee blew for a foul, Maya Yoshida, though clearly on the replay. Got his foot on the ball well and truly first before basically he was kicked by the striker, with the referee being summoned over to the monitor and ultimately overturning his decision and overturning the red card the yellow card he had shown to Yoshida after the incident took place. So this was a perfect illustration of the smoothness of the VAR experience at the Olympics.
Yeah, I think the last time I was on this, we had to go through the horror show that was the Sendai Sapporo game, and I think it took forever going through all those incidents. So I think it's very nice to have a game where, like you both said, everything worked as it's supposed to work. And I just hope that with the Olympics taking place in Japan, I know it's not kind of FIFA sanctioned, but there'll be people at the J League looking at this incident, how it kind of saved Japan, how it went so smoothly, and hopefully this kind of smoothness can maybe be incorporated next season in the G League, so the jingle doesn't come out quite so often.
yeah. Don't get your hopes up, Johnny. But yeah, we can only hope. We can only hope. So from there, yeah, Johnny. I mean, Japan weren't able to cause Spain too many problems, were they? And the Spanish, well, they weren't banging Japan's door down for the rest of the 90 minutes. Yeah, they you know they continued to enjoy the lion's share of possession. And well, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, they weren't looking especially sharp themselves. And again, the conditions would have played a part in that. But yeah, as it entered extra time, I don't know. Did you feel that penalties were inevitable, or were you a little bit worried that Japan were wobbling at that stage?
I think, as you know, I said to you yesterday when you messaged me, I was going to watch the Japan game to its conclusion, then watch the Gamba game in a rerun. So for personal reasons, I kind of feared it was going to go to extra time and penalties. And yeah, but when I kind of joined the game, I was working and then I joined it just after the kind of penalty decision. It did kind of have that feel of, yeah, Spain are obviously, they looked a cut above all the other teams Japan have played. Like, I haven't seen Brazil play in the other games, but I think Spain were definitely a very good technical team and much better than the others. And I think, yeah, Japan, as we mentioned earlier, they were well set, the holding midfielders, the back line. It did look like it was going to be a very tight game and, like, inevitably, one goal deciding it, a bit like what happened in the women's semi-finals. Again, only a single goal there, and then the Brazil-Mexico game obviously going to penalties. I felt, though, like, and it was a slightly off tangent, but, like, it was a real shame that the game's been played in Saitama Stadium, which is a big, big, massive stadium, and I was just watching the game, imagining what it would be like if it was full, like, 60,000, mostly Japanese supporters there, willing their team forward, but instead you had two very good, but ultimately very tired teams kind of going at it. And yeah, that kind of took a bit away from me from the event. But ultimately, as you say, Spain are a very good team. And for Japan to match them for 2 hours is a very, very tough ask, I think.
Yes, indeed. So, the first half of extra time passed with no score. And then, as we've mentioned, yeah, with 5 minutes to go in the second period of extra time, Asensio received the ball on the right-hand side of the box and with his left foot curled across Corsetani and inside his far post. So a moment of quality. Tani's goal certainly had not been peppered throughout the game, but one moment of quality decided it. And with Japan's key attackers, Doan and Kubo, having been subbed off by that point, although Japan were willing themselves forward at the end, yeah, they never really looked like it, did they? And they have to now reboot, I suppose, for a bronze medal match on the 6th of August against Mexico. Sam, who also fell in unfortunate circumstances. In their case, they did hold Brazil for an entire 120 minutes before losing a 4-1 on penalties. So, both of these teams will be licking their wounds when they meet at Saitama Stadium on Friday. What are your expectations for it, Sam? Do you think Moriyasu might shake things up a little bit, or from the experience we have of his management, especially in this tournament, he's probably going to be going with the familiar faces again?
Yeah, I would have thought so, because it's still a bronze medal match. It's that Japan can match their achievement from, I think, 1968. So you've got to go for that. It's still worth playing for. And Japan have a blueprint of how to play against Mexico from earlier in the tournament. And it was that first half an hour, 45 minutes, was arguably the best they've played all tournament. They did play well against France as well. But if they can match that, I mean, it's going to be difficult to kind of match the intensity of that game going deep into this tournament. But if they can manage that, then, yeah, they've got to be full of confidence that they've got a chance to win a bronze medal against a team they've already beaten in this tournament. So I wouldn't expect too many changes, not like a usual third place playoff where you probably make 11 changes and just give everyone a run out. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't see the exact same team that played in that game against Mexico. If you bring Ueda maybe in up front and Hatate can start on that left-hand side, I think, yeah, I wouldn't massively surprise me at all. But From like a personal standpoint, you would of course hope to see players like Mitoma get a bit of a run out, maybe Maeda from the start rather than the odd cameo that he's had, because in this game against Spain, when he came on, he did look quite threatening. He had Japan's best chance with the header from a really good Nakayama cross, which he just couldn't keep down. But yeah, he did look a threat, especially with his pace. So yeah, I'd like to see a little bit more, a little bit of things different. I'd like to see them be more on the front foot as they were in that first half an hour. But yeah, I just think Moriyasu will probably keep it fairly similar to the way he's gone so far.
Yep, all right then. So that's on the Friday night then, the Japan versus Mexico. And then on the Saturday night, it's Spain versus Brazil at Yokohama for the gold medal. All right, let's ever so briefly look back at the quarterfinal against New Zealand before we wrap up the men's under-24s and, also round up the Nadesco Japan quarterfinal. So, we had, of course, Richie Palmer on the podcast last week ahead of Japan's meeting with the Aussie Whites, and I don't know how much time we really need to spend on this game, guys, but it was a very cagey affair, I guess you could say. Japan were obviously coming off two terrific wins over Mexico and France. And I guess, Johnny, if we know anything from experience watching Japan national teams at major tournaments, is you can never count any chickens, can you? Just when they were looking on absolute tip-top form, they ran into an opponent who was able to stifle them basically as effectively as South Africa did in their group stage opener. And, ultimately New Zealand held the Japan all the way to a penalty shootout before Kosei Tani heroics helped them to a 4-2 win. But, it was quite a difficult watch at times, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think you guys did some pretty good analysis, like pre-match analysis with Gifu Richie last week. About, he was talking about like New Zealand's strategy would be to stifle Japan, and we mentioned how Japan and, I didn't mention it, but you guys mentioned that Japan had struggled against South Africa, another team who tend to kind of park the bus. And I think, New Zealand will be disappointed because their tactics almost worked to a T, but obviously they didn't get over the line in the penalty shootout. I must admit I had sort of mixed feelings, because in the penalty shootout, I wanted Japan to win, of course, but when Tani made that first penalty save, I was saying if he could save no more penalties, we don't need to allow any more European clubs to how good he is. So I was quite happy when the next New Zealand player put the ball wide, and then Japan went on to win the penalty shootout. But like you say, it wasn't a classic, but it is very important for Japan. I think that would have killed a lot of momentum, kind of stone dead, if they'd gone out in the quarterfinals to New Zealand, and they still have a chance to medal. So I think, kind of for Japan's sake, all's well that ends well. And I think for New Zealand as well, as Richie said last week, I think they can be pretty proud of their achievements getting to the last eight.
Yeah, most definitely. Again, you can't go back in time, but if Wataru Endo could have just tucked that chance away inside the first 10 minutes, then goodness knows what this game would have ended up like. But it's one of those where I've seen it so many times over the years as an FC Tokyo supporter. You just live to regret that early chance that you miss. And then, in our case, we usually get done by and slightly inferior, in inverted commas, team. But on this occasion, Japan were able to see it through ultimately at the end. But that early chance for Endo, I didn't realise it at the time, but it was to prove basically the key moment of the match, I think, because if he had tucked that away rather than sending his shot ballooning well over the bar, then I just think the game would have gone completely differently.
Yeah, absolutely. Wataru Endo has done many things brilliantly in this tournament, but maybe keep him away from the goal, because that was a terrible effort. But as you say, I think if Japan had gone 1-0 up early, then New Zealand would have had to come out, and it would have left so much space for Doan and Kubo to work in. And I think Japan would have gone on to win that comfortably. But as it was, New Zealand were able to just sit in. They were just able to stifle Japan, and the creativity wasn't really there. They were kind of lacking ideas, maybe lacking a bit of movement. And it was quite disappointing to watch, especially right at the start of the second half. Richie had mentioned how important Winston Reid was going to be for their back line, and he just about made it to start that game, but then went off injured. But then his replacement replacement came on, and Japan just ignored him for the next 20 minutes. They didn't go anywhere near him. They didn't try and put him under pressure, try and work him at all. And he just was allowed to ease into the game, which I thought was really disappointing. And so they got very lucky with the way that they got through that on penalties, and it's going to be something that Japan are going to have to work on, because eventually teams are going to just sit deep against them and stifle them. And it's been shown in two games now that you can kind of nullify Japan doing that. So they need to figure out a way to be a little bit more inventive in that final third, maybe get a little bit of movement from the striker, a little bit more from them, because it was that was a really disappointing game to watch. And they've gone through now, the last two games without scoring. They didn't really look like scoring for much of the South Africa game as well. So, there are definitely things to work on. But the main thing, as Johnny said, was just to get through that game, and they're now at least in with a medal shot.
Yes, indeed. Well said, Sam. All right, so as we wrap up the men then, I guess just if you guys want to kind of give your broader thoughts about perhaps some players that have enhanced their full national team prospects. Johnny, you mentioned a few that have probably already got one foot on the plane to the next World Cup. But, I don't know, maybe a player that was under your radar a little bit heading in that you were pleasantly surprised by, or somebody that you had the expectations for that you felt justified about. For example, for me, Yuta Nakayama was absolutely brilliant, I thought, throughout all of Japan's games, and hopefully will be again in the bronze medal match. So while obviously Kubo was getting the headlines for his goals in the each of the group stage games, Nakayama was terrific. Obviously Yoshida, the captain, marshalled the back line very well alongside Nakayama. And Endo and Tanaka in central midfield were also terrific as well. So I don't know, Sam, were there any other standouts for you?
Well, yeah, you picked out a good couple there. I thought I'll add Itakura to that as well, the way that he stepped in for Tomiyasu at the start of the tournament. And then in that last game, I thought it was absolutely exceptional against Spain. Just the positioning, the way he would put his body on the line, the blocks that he made. And yeah, he's definitely been catching the eye. I mean, there are a lot of rumours that he might be joining Postecoglou at Celtic, and I think that would be a really interesting move for him. But yeah, he's done his cause no harm, and as Johnny said earlier, it's really nice to see that if we miss Tomiyasu or Yoshida, then there is a player of Itakura's quality to come through. And then just the one I want to throw to Johnny is that he's mentioned Kosei Tani a little bit now. What do you see kind of as Tani's future? Obviously he's a Gamba player on loan at Shonan, but Gamba still have Higashiguchi in goal. What do you see, Higashiguchi being moved out to allow Tani to play for Gamba, or do you see his future lying elsewhere?
Well, Tani's performance has obviously been excellent for Japan, but they've kind of thrown a bit of a spanner in the works for Gamba, because obviously we're going to come on to talk about them in part two, and Higashiguchi hasn't yet, his levels haven't dropped at all. He's still one of the best in J1. So it would be a big, big call if they were to next season move Higashiguchi out and bring Tani in. Prior to this tournament, I actually expected Osako to be the starting goalkeeper. I know Gamba supporters sometimes kind of mention Moriyasu having a bit of a bit of favouritism towards Sanfrecce players like Sasaki in the full national team and Osako. But yeah, Tani's won out. He's done very well here. I thought if Shonan looked like they might stay in J1 again next season, I thought they would loan him again to Shonan next year and potentially even the year after that, and then bring him back in to replace Higashiguchi when he starts to fade a bit. Like I said, though, I was kind of joking with the penalty save against New Zealand. And yeah, although you mentioned rightly, his kicking or his distribution or some of his decision-making against Spain wasn't great. But I still think there'll be clubs out there, for example, in places like Belgium or Portugal, Austria, might look at him as his size, his physique. The fact that he was going up against a high-quality side like Spain. He's played against other teams like Mexico and France. We don't see many Japanese goalkeepers go overseas, especially as young as Tani. But I think, Gamba don't have a great recent history of keeping young players on board for very long. So, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see him head off to Europe sometime before Qatar 2022. What would you say to that, Sam?
Well, it'd be your luck that you'd move Higashiguchi out, Tani would play three games, and you'd lose him to Europe. So, yeah, I mean, I was fairly impressed with most of what he did in the tournament. As I say, there were a few areas where I think, but it's his age as well. I mean, goalkeepers aren't going to peak until their late 20s. There's still going to be issues with him. I think there were just times in that second half where Spain were really getting on top, but Tani was kind of over-enthusiastic in the way that he wanted to just clear the ball and set Japan out on a counter-attack that the rest of the team weren't on board for. So, and it just allowed Spain to have a little bit more possession. But in terms of, yeah, as you say, his physique, he was getting to most of the crosses, he was dealing with those well. His presence, his saves were, it's just kind of getting out of those one-on-ones. I thought he did terrifically. So I'm sure that some teams will have had their eye on this tournament, had their eye on Tani. And I agree with you. I think places like Belgium, maybe he'll join the band at Sint-Truidense there. But there, yeah, other places, you could see Tani move on. If I was Gamba and I was confident of not losing him to Europe, I think your route of just allowing him a couple more seasons at Shonan would be best for his development and then for Gamba once he eventually comes in there. But I don't think that's going to be a guarantee. So, yeah, I would maybe think that Tani could go next winter, maybe next summer. So you might just want to keep him in. I don't know. Yeah, it's difficult. What do you do with him? Because Higashiguchi is too good to drop. So, yeah, I think you keep him at Shonan, but Shonan are kind of, I think you've just got to go wave goodbye to Tani and say, I'm sorry, you're not going to play for us, but all the best in Europe.
Well, that's it. I mean, Higashiguchi's 35, which to most people, listeners from other countries, would think that was a goalkeeper at the tail end of his career. But, of course, the way goalkeepers are treated in Japan, he might have another 5 or 6, at a minimum, years left in the top division. I mean, my wife spotted the Yoshikatsu Kawaguchi on the bench for the Olympic team and asked me if he was one of the overage players. I had to let her know that he was one of the support staff. But yeah, she was she was thinking that with the as we all know how Eiji Kawashima is still in the main national team frame. It doesn't really matter how old you are for goalkeepers in Japan. If you've still got a pulse and a pair of gloves, then you basically you've got a job. So yeah, for me, I would just maybe sad as it might be for Gamba supporters to have never seen Tani get a proper chance for your first team as the number one, Johnny. Yeah, I think I don't know if you could really stand in his way if he gets a job offer from overseas. Can you with Higashiguchi showing no signs of slowing down, as you both said? I don't think they can make any guarantees to Tani. So that's as unfortunate that would be. Again, if you do get a commitment from him that he wouldn't go, then you can keep loaning him out. But I don't think you can properly put a time frame on Higashiguchi's time at the club either, can you?
Yeah, I think Gamba kind of run in the same system I think Kashima have done for a number of years, that they're quite happy to let younger players go in the expectation that when they do come back to the J-League, a la Idiguchi and Usami, they will rejoin Gamba. So obviously, like Doan, I don't expect him back in Japan anytime soon, but we'd kind of expect him to come back. And like I know one player we haven't really mentioned much is Daichi Hayashi, the forward. He was a Gamba Junior youth player, and the Gamba fans on Twitter seem to be claiming him. There is a kind of feeling like I think he would go with the club's blessing, obviously with a heavy heart, but in the expectation if things didn't work out in Europe or when he gets to Kawaguchi or Kawashima age, he'd be back in Japan and pulling on the gloves for Gamba at some point in the future.
All right then. So the men, as we've said numerous times at the end of this part, they've still got a bronze medal to play for, and let's wish them all the best for that against Mexico on Friday. Last Friday, unfortunately, the Nadeshiko Japan came to the end of their Olympic road when they lost 3-1 to Sweden at Saitama Stadium. Sam, you mentioned it earlier. It was probably their best performance of the four they played throughout the Tokyo 2020 Olympics. But, yeah, they came up against a very resolute opponent, a strong Sweden team. And, yeah, unfortunately for Japan, even though it was, as you say, their best performance of the competition, they definitely didn't get the rub of the green. And, yeah, Sweden have emerged 3-1 victors.
Yeah, I thought Japan kind of went toe-to-toe with them for maybe the first 60 minutes, and then I think the quality eventually showed from Sweden, and they got in front and they kind of held on and were quite comfortable towards the end. I think maybe the turning point of the game was the penalty that was initially awarded for Tanaka and then was overturned by VAR.
This week in VAR. This week in VAR. This week.
I mean, this was a more contentious use of VAR for me, because the replays that were shown were not great. They were just the one angle, and it was quite far away, and it showed there was a coming together, but didn't really show much else than that. And, I mean, I can assume that the VAR has had better angles and been able to make a more informed opinion on this, but from what we saw, at least one of the broadcasts that I saw, there was a coming together, and if the penalty had already been given, there didn't seem anything clear and obvious to overturn that. So I guess in this situation, we just have to assume that the referee has been able to see more clearly than we have and has got the decision correct. But yeah, that was unfortunate. If Japan went 2-1 up at that point, I mean, yeah, you're looking at a completely different game, because yeah, after going 1-0 down, they responded very well in that first half.
Yeah, right out of the gate, Sweden looked absolutely irrepressible, didn't they? And they took a seventh-minute lead through an Eriksson header. But then, yeah, Mina Tanaka was able to equalise for Japan in the 23rd minute when she converted a lovely cross from Yui Hasegawa. And then, Japan being back on level terms, they definitely grew in confidence. And, that penalty overturn was a puzzling one. As you say, yeah, from the replays that we were shown, we can only hope that the VAR had a much better view of things on a different angle that wasn't shown on the main broadcast, because that was hugely frustrating for Nadeshko Japan. And then as the second half went on, as you say, Sam, although Nadeshko did make a bright start to it, ultimately Sweden took the lead 8 minutes after the break, and then the unfortunate Narumi Miura was penalised for one of those really ordinary VAR handballs just past the hour. And then in the 68th minute, Sweden made it 3-1, and that was unfortunately that. So Johnny, I guess they made a very sluggish start to the tournament, Nadeshko Japan, and unfortunately, as we've said, they played their best game in their in the game that saw them knocked out. But the way that Sweden had played earlier on in the tournament, we could hardly be surprised at the way they saw off Nadeshko Japan, can we?
Yeah, obviously, we mentioned in the green room, Gamba have been playing a lot, so I haven't really managed to watch a full Nadeshko game, even though I've kind of followed the results of the tournament. I did see Sweden play in the semi-finals, and obviously in the women's game, they're a top side. I think they've medalled, I can't remember the last few Olympics, that they're always there or thereabouts. And I think, like, in the game against Japan and also against Australia in the semis, I think that real kind of knockout experience paid dividends for them. Like, they didn't play brilliant, expansive football, but they were able to just win the key moments and kind of grind out the wins and get through. And, I think Sweden are playing Canada in the final, and they look good for the gold medalist position. So it's kind of unfortunate for Nadeshko they had to run up against such a strong opponent, like, in the quarterfinal. But, like you say, they started the group stage slowly, so that they got that tough draw in the quarterfinals. And, you know, it's interesting because the men's and the women's teams, the roles have almost been reversed in this Olympics, because naturally you expect Nadeshko to do better in a World Cup or an Olympics than the men's team, but they've just not been able to get it together in this tournament, which must be a bitter blow, especially coming at home. But obviously Nadeshko are one of the better teams in the world, so I just hope they can get things together and find a way to move forward from here.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, I think we've done pretty well with our guests in recent weeks, haven't we, Sam? I mean, Johnny mentioned how spot on Richie was with his analysis in our preview of the Japan-New Zealand game. And yeah, back before the Olympics started, Alex Bishop was on, obviously talking about Nadeshiko Japan and the lack of flexibility in Asako Takakura's formation. And although Alex did ultimately tip Japan for a medal, I guess out of hope more than anything, perhaps. But he did express his concern, I guess you could say, that Japan were more possession for possession's sake, and ultimately Takakura's formation was pretty much set in stone. So I guess we saw the limits of Takakura's squad and of her system at times throughout this tournament. And although Japan, obviously, with the all best intentions, they were just unfortunately that they can't really have too many complaints about not making it through to the final four, can they?
No, I don't think so. What I would say is that the formation was very rigid, and the only real changes were maybe change the two up top or maybe change the wide players. But I think at least it's you could see, especially in that Sweden game, that the formation can work to a point. And if I think just the performances let them down in those first two games, especially Canada, you'd have thought Japan should have taken the game to them a little bit more. But just even in that game, the possession wasn't really working for them. They weren't keeping the ball, so they weren't even playing to their strengths in that game. And the same really against GB. So if they'd have started well, even playing that same the way that the manager wanted them to play, then they would have avoided Sweden. They would have gone through at a higher group's position and maybe had a slightly easier ride and got to that medal match that Alex did predict for them. But yeah, they were just generally disappointing, I think, at the start of the tournament. And there was kind of a lack of impetus. That was what I would say for most of that tournament. And then besides Iwabuchi, there wasn't really anyone that you thought was guaranteed to go and score or take their chance when they went through. And when they were limited as much as they were in the first few games, and then they got a few chances against Sweden, but really just didn't take them. So that's what kind of cost them from, especially in that quarterfinal. So it's a fairly similar problem the men's teams and just kind of seemingly Japanese teams in general have. It's just that putting the ball in the back of the net. So as well as the formation, I don't think worked particularly well. I'd like to have seen it a bit more flexible, because especially when it wasn't working for them in those first two games, Japan just did not change and were just kind of, especially in that Britain game, they were kind of swatted aside. So maybe, I think Itakura has been relieved of her duties, hasn't she? So it'd be interesting to see what sort of manager comes in after that, and how they kind of mix up this team, because you do think a little bit more energy is required.
Yeah, I don't know what Momoko Kinoshita did to not make the match day squad. She was terrific, I thought, in the second half when she came on against Chile. But not to Takakura's liking, clearly far too attacking for Takakura, so she left her out. But so it's an unfortunate exit for Japan at the quarterfinal stage. And gents, if you're expecting me to gloat about Australia knocking out Team GB at the same stage in match of the tournament, trademark. Unfortunately, I'm not going to do that, because as an Australian, we're all still livid at the fact that Australia have been denied a perfectly good goal in our semi-final against Sweden and have ultimately lost 1-0 to the Swedes, who advanced to, as Johnny said earlier, to face a Canada in the gold medal match. And that is on Friday morning, interestingly enough, at the National Stadium. So hopefully it won't be too hot, but I reckon it probably will be at 11 a.m. Friday morning when Sweden take on Canada. So it's Australia versus the US for the bronze medal on Thursday evening up in Kashima. So come on the Matildas, let's bring home the bronze. All right, well, that is our look back at the Olympic football tournament. Of course, we will touch on how Japan get on against Mexico in the bronze medal match in next week's episode. But for now, we'll pause for a brief hit of music, and when we return, we'll get Johnny's thoughts on Gunbar Osaka's recent exploits. Welcome back. And we mentioned it ever so briefly earlier on. But yes, while most of J1 has been enjoying an Olympic break, for Gunba Osaka, it's been an entirely different story, Johnny. Since you've returned from your ACL exploits, you've obviously had to play catch-up after the coronavirus halted the start of your campaign. Where to start with all of these games? I guess, as an overarching thing, as you've basically caught up now to the teams above you and edged your way up the table, how have you felt the team and the squad have handled all of these games coming in such quick succession?
Well, it basically couldn't have gone any better. They've taken 12 points from six games, and 2 points a game projected over a whole season would have you in the ACL where they were last season. I think a couple of things to point out. Gamba, like all the other ACL teams, they actually had to stay in a hotel, like in a bubble, when they came back for the first 2 weeks in Japan. So the Fukuoka, Kobe and Kashima games, Gamba players still hadn't seen their families like face-to-face for about a month by that point. So maybe when you got to the Oita game, like Usami obviously scored the winner in the last minute, and then he kind of broke down in tears in the post-match like hero interview, I think. In his older age, he's not just an emotional player. I think that might be some of the kind of emotion of that situation coming out, because obviously a lot of these players have young families, and being in Osaka but not being able to see them obviously was a bit draining. But yeah, after the Kashima game, you think things are going a bit flat, and then 20 minutes to go against Oita, they're 1-0 down despite dominating, but they managed that. That's the real key point. They got the win against Oita, and then they've been able to press on. And, if you said to me at the beginning of this run, like, Gamba has still got one game in hand, and if they win, albeit against a very tough Yokohama F. Marino side, then they're only 6 points off sixth place. I mean, it literally could not have gone much better than that. And I think one thing I didn't take into consideration was, obviously, the focus on Gamba playing in the summer. They're going to be tired. They have rotated pretty well. We've got tons of injuries in the wide places, which we can't rotate, but in the middle we are rotating. But the other teams, like Kashima, when they played us, they hadn't played for 2 weeks. Then Oita, it's 2.5 weeks. Sapporo, 3 weeks. Sendai, 3.5 weeks. Marinos, who do take a while to get going, haven't played for nearly a month, whereas we've been playing every 3 or 4 days. So obviously we're tired, but other teams are struggling to get going after such a long break and playing against a kind of battle-hardened side. So, yeah, it feels good. This is the first time this season I've been on and been able to say positive things about Gamba, so I hope that's coming over.
Absolutely. And I think you made a very good point there about the teams and not really being up to speed, the ones that you're playing against, and Gamba. But I think it's by winning games that you've been able to maintain a bit of a roll and a bit of momentum through these games. I think that Oita game, if you've lost that 1-0 and you continue into this run in a negative spiral, then it could really have got out of hand, and you could still be kind of right rooted into that position. But that victory, I think, was absolutely crucial in the manner of getting that victory as well. And I think that's just kind of rolled on to the Sapporo game, and then I didn't see much of the Sendai game, but yeah, another good victory there, and it's all looking really positive for Gamba. And as you say, the teams that you're up against are kind of coming into it cold and maybe taking a bit of time to get into the game, whereas Gamba are quite, as you say, they've managed to rotate pretty well, and the team is still, it looks quite fresh. I mean, Usami's minutes have been managed very well. He was like kind of being used as that impact sub for a little while before starting against Sendai. So yeah, I think the management has been pretty good, although I still have reservations about the quality of play from Gamba. I don't think it's been absolutely mesmerising stuff, but it doesn't need to be at this point. You've got the points on the board, you're up into mid-table, and I think any lingering relegation fears are all but clear.
Yeah, I think we've got, obviously we've played Marinos on Friday, which is our final game in hand, and then next week we play Tokushima and Shimizu. But then the schedule, like, because obviously they announced the final dates for this, final dates and times for all the schedule up to the end of the season today. And I noticed, like, basically from September on, Gamba only have one midweek league game. So if we can just get through this period now, and then from September we can play like Miura, Shoji and Kim at the back every week. We can get Usami, Wellington, Silva and Pereira working as a front line, and get two holding midfielders, not constantly changing who's sitting there. I think we will be okay, and we'll be able to push up to kind of mid-table, upper mid-table. I think, you know, they brought in Ko Yanagisawa, another very difficult name to say, from Mito, and he came on against Sendai. Again, when he came on, Gamba were just sort of nursing the 1-0 win. There was a lot of tired bodies there. I'm wondering if he might start against Marinos. There's been like rumours of other players potentially coming in, but like I said, because Gamba have kind of kicked on a bit, I was kind of half hoping like someone like Daiki Sugiyoka from Kashima or Nagoya have three very good like fullbacks, but now Nagoya and Kashima start to see Gamba as maybe slightly a bit of a threat, so it's going to be difficult to get one of those players. So yeah, it's interesting to see where we go, and obviously, like, you know, for example, best case scenario, if Gamba were to say draw with Marinos, beat Tokushima, beat Shimizu, like just grind out results, then because Matsunami is just a caretaker, and like I mentioned the last time I was on Akira Nishino, he's now out of work. Would they think, right, we've got ourselves clear of relegation, we'll bring in a new coach and get his new ideas over this season, or, you know, will they wait till the off season? How would you see that kind of going, Sam?
Well, that's always the worry, in my opinion. You do too well with Matsunami and then you give him a couple of years of a contract. So, it would make perfect sense the way you describe it if you see Gamba as quite a safe mid-table team. You can get a few months to bed in the new manager if that's Nishino or if that's someone else. I kind of tend to think that Matsunami will see out the season and then you'll make a decision, come the end of the season and go with a new coach at that point. But I think, as for whatever criticism I've given Matsunami, you've got to give him credit for the way that Gamba have managed to grind out these results, and it has been a grind at times. But you've done exactly what you had to do. You had that period before the ACL where you needed those points, and you got those points in those three games, and he's done the same here. So you've got to give him a lot of credit, and I'm pretty sure he will see out this season.
A lot of the focus has been on Gamba's attack, and rightly so, the lack of goals. But I'd just like to give a bit of credit to the defence, which has been rotated, especially in the wide areas. But they've only conceded 18 goals in 21 games this season, got 9 clean sheets, which is better than they managed the whole of last year when they had a pretty solid defence. So, yeah, hopefully, like, numbers are kind of ticking up in terms of like expected goals, shots on target and things like that. So hopefully the second half of the season we can kind of nudge up a bit and at least get sort of number of games played and number of goals scored level. But yeah, like I said, the Cerezo fans were giving it big licks early in the season, and now Gamba have pleasingly drawn level in points with the Cerezo team. It's only won one of their last 13. Gamba, you know, 6 wins in their last 9. So it's been a long time coming this year, but finally there's some, we're not out of it yet, but you can see a bit of light at the end of the tunnel, I think.
Well, yeah, as you say, Johnny, basically it could have hardly gone any better, especially, the last 3 games. We mentioned in our last episode that you'd come from behind to beat Oita, as you both mentioned here on this episode as well. And then since then, yes, a 2-0 away win over Sapporo last Friday, and then 1-0 away at Sendai on Tuesday. All of the goals in those last couple of games coming from different scorers. Patrick got the winner up in Sendai, and as you say, the team has been rotated, and it hasn't always been the easiest on the eye, but the results are the most important thing, especially in such a testing set of fixtures. So well done to Gamba for edging their way up the table. And Johnny, after you play Yokohama F Marinos at home on Friday, you're going to be in the very unfamiliar position of having played more games than some of the teams around you. This will be take some getting used to, I'm sure, but for example, Sapporo and Cerezo themselves, they will both have a game in hand on you after after Friday night. So that's a very unusual situation. But Gamba have slogged their way through and worked their way up to 13th in the table. And taking on second place Yokohama F Marinos on Friday should be a very interesting game, as F Marinos obviously tried to keep some sort of pace with the Kawasaki at the top of the league. All right, and then obviously after that game on Friday, the league as a whole will resume after the Olympics with match day 23. All of the games will be played on the national holiday, Monday, the 9th of August. And, a full slate of games. So it's back into things. And, we'll be back with a new episode of the podcast recording next Tuesday night for hopefully a Wednesday release. So before we finish up, guys, I did warn you that we would I would throw this question at you. So we are officially past the halfway point of the season, of course, but with a number of significant moves being made in the transfer window that is still open for another week or so, and obviously the Olympic break again happening for most teams. Most teams are resetting for what's left to come in what's left of the second half of the season. So, I prepped you for this. Maybe a couple of teams to watch or players to watch after they've transferred either between teams or into the league. Sam, do you want to go first with a couple of your selections?
Yeah, I'll start at the bottom of the table. I'll give Yokohama FC some airtime, which they don't usually get. But they have thrown their dice. They've thrown everything at this, trying to stay up. They've made a few very intriguing signings. The first is a German goalkeeper who's been at the Olympics with the German Olympic team, Sven Brodersen, who's coming from St. Pauli. He looks like he should be their new number one goalkeeper. And Yuto Minami's gone out to J2 somewhere, I think. Almere, I think it was. And then Arthur Silva's come in from FC Tokyo. He's not really got a lot of game time there, but he should have bolstered their midfield a little bit. And then they've got three kind of wild card Brazilians, which I love it when a team just decides to go for wild cards. But they look like, on paper, very good players. They've come in from teams like Atlético Mineiro, one of the best teams in Brazil. Felipe Viseu, I think it is, who's played for Udinese and also at Ceará in Brazil as well, the team that Thiago Pagnussac came from at Cerezo, and they all look like they've got a bit of pedigree about them. You expect them all, I think, to go into that first team. You've got a centre-back, a striker, and then a kind of right winger, so it's a little bit of everything for them. They've got to settle in. They don't know how well they're going to settle in. It's lucky for them that we haven't got this sign of delay that we did at the start of the season. So players are able to come into Japan and quarantine during this break. So they should be up to speed fairly quickly. Maybe not for the first game back, but fairly soon. So Yokohama just need those really to click immediately and hopefully power them to a few results. Because what are they now? They are 9 points from safety. They need to get going, and they need to get going quickly. So they'll be really interesting to watch to see if that gamble can pay off. And then just a couple of players. I don't want to steal too much from Johnny when he comes on, but the one I'm most looking forward to is Jakub, and I'll take the bullet for this name. Jakub Szwerszok, I think, for Nagoya. Sorry for any Polish listeners for what I've done to that name. But he's come in. Nagoya have needed a striker for so long. It's been so obvious with Kakitani and Yamasaki playing there, and Yamasaki's now injured. He's probably going to miss the rest of the season. So Szwerszok comes in. With the Poland national team at the Euros. He's got 15 in 23 last season for his team Piast Gliwice, which is another one I've butchered, but let's go with that. But it looks like a real natural goal scorer. He's described to me as just a player, as long as you get in the ball, he will score. He's an instinctive finisher. So you've got to imagine with Mateus feeding him and Sommer and Saito feeding him, you expect him to get a few goals, and maybe he's the missing piece for Nagoya going forward into a maybe challenging for a Champions League place and maybe a little bit beyond that. And then the other one I'm quite interested to see from a different scale is Riku Danzaki. He's a young player. He's just come back to Sapporo. He's had a loan spell at Brisbane Roar. He always had a little bit of talent in the kind of League Cup games I watched him play for Sapporo, but he excelled in the A-League for Brisbane, was a key player for them. He was, very much like one of the first names on the team sheet. So he comes into a Sapporo team that is really lacking quite at the top of the pitch, with Anderson Lopez having left. They've that our friend Gabriel Okechukwu has gone on loan to J3, so that really hasn't worked out. It's amazing that just because Olunga was African, that all Africans aren't great footballers going up front, aren't they? But yeah, they're missing a lot going forward, so Dan Zaki could really add a little bit to that. So I'm interested to see how well he comes in. Johnny, what have you picked out?
Luckily, we've gone down different avenues, so it makes it quite easy for me. So I've picked out one team, and I think we briefly mentioned in the green room, and that's Shimizu S-Pulse, who made a very eye-catching signing, I think yesterday or a couple of days ago, of Daiki Matsuoka, who I think is a young player we're all fans of. The only thing that makes sense to me about this transfer is that last year I said that Matsuoka would fit in well with a Lotina system. The only thing is, last year obviously that was a Seveso side challenging at the top of the league and not a kind of perennial mid-table side like Shimizu. I don't know where this money's coming from, because they've brought in another player called Ronaldo, not one of the famous ones, but he does come from Flamengo, and a player I'm worried about butchering his name too, Benjamin Kololi. I don't know if Lionel Pigre can correct me on that one. I think he's born and raised in Switzerland, but he plays internationally for Kosovo. And also Akira Ibayashi is coming from Sanfrecce. I think he worked with Lotina as well. Yeah, on paper, because I think you've mentioned rightly before, Shimizu's midfield, like central midfield, needs a bit of an upgrade. So if Matsuoka and Ronaldo can connect well, and Kololi as well, they could kick on to like the top half of the league. But we did say that at the start of this season, that we thought that Shimizu had brought in a lot of good players, and then people like Katayama, Hara, Suzuki at the back have got injured, and they've kind of had to go back to the same defences last year. Shimizu are one of these teams that I had a bit of a go at Kashiwa last time I was on. It's like the players are there, but the off-field management's just a bit not right. Like, everything they've done off the field since finishing eighth in 2018 sort of screams, we don't know what we're doing. All these changes, and players like Hwang Suk-ho are good at Shimizu, then they let them go to Sagan Tosu, and they turn out to be really good after not getting a game at Shimizu. They bring in El Sino from Kawasaki, and he does nothing. Again, like I said with Kashiwa, I do not see the logic in having 7 or 8 foreign players on your books at one time who are all good enough to get into the first 11. They wasted a year's salary on Neto Volpi last year, who was he seemed to be good enough to be first choice, but he ended up being fourth choice because they couldn't fit him into the team. So it's Shimizu do have the players now to kick on. Whether they're held back off the field, I don't know. In terms of kind of individual players, I sort of went down the line of players who came in after the kind of bubble at the start of the year. One player, like Diego Pituca at Kashima, I thought he was excellent against Gamba. He looked like he'd been there for a long time, kind of box to box all over the place. I think he's someone that, maybe not this season, but maybe next season, you could look at as potential like J1 best 11. Also Pedro Raul at Kashiwa. Like, Kashiwa are in big trouble now that Gamba have gone 6 points ahead of them with a game in hand, and he has scored a few goals. I think they really need him to step up and score goals. From my side, Gamba, I think Wellington Silva, we've talked about him before, but it's starting to come together for him. There was a kind of 10 or 15 minute spell against Sapporo. He was essentially an attacking cheat code. Like, Gamba would just soak up a bit of Sapporo pressure, win the ball back, pass to Silva, who'd run at the defence, and they didn't know how to handle him. So he's coming on well. John Mary, I think, at Avispa, who've kind of slipped down, they really need goals from him. He's got the pedigree. You just need to keep him fit and firing. And a player I actually meant to mention last time I was on, because we were talking about Oita against Urawa, and he also impressed me for Oita against Gamba, is that the centre-back Enrique Trevisan. I think it's one of these things, like you're mentioning, like Yokohama FC kind of doing the Brazilian bingo or just bringing in random Brazilians. They've brought in, I think, Matias Pereira, who's not done anything. And then they brought in Trevisan, who, with the greatest respect to Oita, he looks a bit too good to be there. He's just kind of come in the centre of defence, and he settled things down. And especially with issues of bringing new foreigners into the country, I don't think he's going to be at Oita next season, regardless of what division they're in. The last two players on this very lengthy list, Daya Tono at Kawasaki. I think now that if Mitoma's leaving and that Oshima seems to be injured, Tanaka is gone, he might have a few more chances to shine. And then a player who's been given kind of big reps on here the last few weeks, Yuta Higuchi, scored another beautiful goal against Cerezo. I wonder if Matsuoka's gone. if he stays at Tosa, I don't think he's with there much longer. I think he could go to Europe. How about you, Ben? Is there anyone else or any other teams you'd like to add to? I know me and Sam have covered a lot of names there.
No, that's brilliant, Johnny. Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. From literally the top to the bottom of J1, that's absolutely sensational. I guess for regular listeners who know me as an FC Tokyo supporter, they won't be surprised that the player who I'm going to mention, who is rumoured to be returning to J1, and that's Yoshinori Muto, who has been released by Newcastle United in the English Premier League, and strong rumours linking him with a return to Japan, but not to a return to FC Tokyo. Rather, he might be the one to try and fill Kyogo Furuhashi's boots at Vissel Kobe. So that would be a tough one for me to take as an FC Tokyo supporter, after Muto is one of our favourite sons, of course. But it would be fascinating to see him return and obviously get a chance to shine again after his opportunities were basically non-existent at Newcastle, and then he had to look elsewhere for games on loan. So if he does return, Muto, then that would be one player I would definitely be looking out for. But so many intriguing stories and teams to watch in the second half of the season. Basically, from the bottom up, as you say, Sam, with the Yokohama FC pushing the boat out, and let's see if they can really turn this into a proper relegation dogfight, because there certainly are a number of teams down around the foot of the table that Yokohama FC, of course, currently occupy, and they're well and truly cut adrift. Johnny, you've mentioned the Daiya Tono there, and what might happen at Kawasaki Frontale. So I don't know, guys, just for a bit of fun, do you give any chance to Yokohama F Marinos to catch them, Sam, and to turn this into a proper title race? Do you think, with three or four games to go, the title could be up in the air, or will the Frontale have wrapped it up by then?
I've got to give them a chance. They've played very well in that kind of, when they're catching up with their Kawasaki's games, they've just kept on winning. It didn't really matter to them that Postecoglou left, they just carried on. And Kawasaki, if they lose Mitoma as well, and Tanaka's already gone, obviously Ryota Oshima got injured in the last game he played, so that leaves a large gap in midfield that they haven't looked to fill at the moment. So it doesn't look like, I've not seen any rumours that they might be bringing in players. So the squad begins to look quite thin, and you can see holes there developing in that, especially if they go deeper into the ACL. I mean, they've got a very tough game. I think it's a one-legged away game against Ulsan Hyundai, which is a scant reward for finishing unbeaten in your group with a 100% record. But it looks like a difficult end to the season for Kawasaki and Yokohama. It just depends how Kevin Muscat settles in, because that's kind of a bit of an unknown. He's obviously going to want to change things around a little bit from the way that Postecoglou had them playing. And they've got a few different players in now with everyone's favourite Kenyu Sugimoto. So how do they fit his wonderful goal-scoring ability into their team? And they've got Ryo Miyachi as another one who's kind of interesting to see if he can be fit, and then if he can then fit into this team, and where does he fit in, and where do all these pieces fit in. So Yokohama are a really interesting one, but if they can continue their form that they were showing pre-Olympic break, then I absolutely think we've got a title race on, and I don't see it extending further than those two teams. Mm-hmm. But I do think this would go down to maybe the last two or three games of the season at least.
Yeah, I'm confident enough, like you, Sam, to say I think a team from Kanagawa will win the league, but which one is still kind of up in the air at the moment? I do think, though, obviously I'm a Gamba fan, so I would kind of put more emphasis on this, but Friday's game is actually, I think, it's a very losable game for Marinos. You might not think, but the fact, like, last season Gamba won away to Marinos in the first day of the season, and Marinos looked terrible that day, and they started this season very poorly. They do tend to start or restart quite slowly. So this is definitely a banana skin, and it's one of their two games in hand. So if they were to, say, lose it, and then they're 12 points behind with one game in hand, it really does start to look like kind of check to Kawasaki. And Kawasaki, they always seem to have someone up their sleeve, like Tachibanada, maybe someone like that, Tono, Ten Miyagi might kind of come in. Whereas, again, Marinos, like, when I was gone, Maeda, who won't play against Gamba this Friday because he's with the Olympics, he might have gotten the shot window he could go to. And then, like you mentioned, you've got Sugiyoka as a forward option. Leo Ciara is the other option. He's not really been in the team lately, and he has come from like Serie B in Brazil, so he's not quite as the same level as, say, a Marcos Jr. or Elber. Yeah, I think these two are going to be the top two. There's too many question marks at the moment at Marinos too, especially with Muscat to come in, for me to say they're going to overtake Kawasaki. So if pressed, I would have to say Kawasaki will hold on, but Marinos, I think they'll definitely be the top two.
Well, that's right, Johnny. Yeah, this Friday, it is one of their games in hand. They're 12 points behind with two games in hand on Kawasaki, Yokohama F. Marinos. But yes, they play on Friday. And then their next game in hand, or their last game in hand, I should say, is actually next Thursday, the 12th, when they'll play their match day 18 fixture at home against Nagoya at Mitsuzawa. Of course, Nagoya, up in fifth in the table, so that will not be a walk in the Mitsuzawa Park either. And, that's obviously after F. Marinos play on the Monday, and then they have to play again on Sunday in match day 24. So, F. Marinos will understand how Gamba have been feeling in the past few weeks, Johnny, after they get those games in hand out of the way. So, yeah, hopefully they can, not necessarily win on Friday, because Johnny would like Gamba to do that. But, hopefully they can make it into an interesting title race in the second half of the season. And down at the foot of the table, well, it's anybody's guess, especially if Yokohama FC can hit on a couple of their Brazilians. Don't worry, guys, I won't ask you for a prediction on which four teams are going to go down. But we will leave it there, I think, for this week. So our wrap of the Olympic football tournaments, again, with the Japan men having one game to play, and we wish them all the best in their bronze medal match against Mexico. And then, after Agamba, Yokohama F. Marinos on Friday, J1 resumes in full on Monday, August the 9th, with match day 23. I guess, Sam, most people are going to be working who are listening to this, so we can't really do a pick of the weekend, but I don't know, a pick of the Monday fixtures. Is there one game in particular that stands out to you?
Rather none of them did. Monday fixtures are not what I'm all about. I'm glad you can all enjoy your holiday, but I won't be. But let's have a look at them. I haven't really checked the fixtures out.
Got to say, they are not really turning my head. I think Tosu FC Tokyo is the only game that features two top half teams. But apart from that, it's pretty much a bottom half team against a top half team, I think.
Yeah, Tokyo really won't want to watch that game. You usually have a terrible record recently against Saga and Tosu. Try and ignore that one. I think pick of the games maybe looks to be Kobe versus Kashiwa. I mean, Kobe, without Furuhashi, they kind of did okay with Tanaka scoring in the last game they played. And what Kashiwa had, they're a million of Brazilians, and loads of injuries. So it'd be interesting to see, as Nelsinho works something out over the break, and can they perform much better than they currently have been, and push on in the way that Gamba have up the table. So I think that's an interesting one to see how Kashiwa start on that their restart, because if they lose straight away, then they're right in the thick of this relegation battle. But yeah, straight away a victory over Kobe, when maybe they could be there for the taking, when they're trying to figure out a way of playing without that club, what has been their best player this season. It might be the best opportunity for Reysel. So yeah, looking at a pretty ordinary on paper looking fixture list, I think that's the one that sticks out to me.
I think I would pick out actually Cerezo against Sendai, which might not leap out at you, but bear in mind Cerezo have drawn the last two league games 3-3, and they've also beaten Niigata 3-2 tonight in the Emperor's Cup. So they seem to be doing an impression of Nishino era Gamba, and it's a big game for Sendai as well, because Sendai played okay against Gamba, but they're now 9 points off Gamba, and they're still 3 points off safety. So yeah, Cerezo as well, they don't want to get dragged into a relegation dogfight. So I think, that one might have goals and also a bit of intrigue in the bottom half of the league.
Yes, indeed. All right. Thanks very much, Johnny. And, thanks very much for returning to the podcast again, mate. Always great to get your thoughts on Gumbra, of course. But, yes, on this occasion, also the national teams at the Olympics. And, I was going to say you're looking forward to the league resuming. But, yeah, of course, it's been happening all the way through for you. So you've been enjoying a steady stream of Gumbra football throughout the Olympics. So, once again, great to catch up with you. And we look forward to doing so again soon.
Thanks for having me on again, Ben. I hope I wasn't too overly positive about Gumbra for all the other supporters of other teams, but I'm understandably a bit delighted. But yeah, it's good to have the G League back fully from next Monday, and I'll look forward to coming back on sometime in the future. Thanks.
Yeah, terrific stuff, mate. I think you deserve it after the testing start to the season that Gumbra had. So it's good to see, your team getting some positive results. And, don't blame you at all for your positivity. That's absolutely terrific. And, Sam, again, thanks for holding on for an extra day for this recording, mate. And, another terrific episode. You're obviously going to... So you're getting very busy again with J1 resuming. And, I'm sure you're looking forward to it. Half of you is, and half of you is going to be working... nose to the grindstone again, but we'll catch up again next week, hopefully with Japan in possession of a bronze medal, and after J1 has resumed.
Yeah, I always look forward to the league resuming. I know it's going to be a lot of work, and a Monday morning 5 a.m. start is not what I'm all about, but yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And thank you for not rubbing our noses in it too much about the Team GB versus Australia result. I mean, I thought we might have come to blows after that 4-3, but yeah, I'm glad we've kept it civilised.
yes. No, we're not sore winners, us Australians. So happy to win that and move on to the next one. Just unfortunately, we got jibbed against Sweden. But anyway, that is it for this week's episode of the J Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Johnny Nicol very much for his time on this episode. We'd like to thank our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/jtalkpod. And of course, listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week again to review Japan's bronze medal match against Mexico, and also the resumption of the J1 season. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast.